Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, February 18th, 2016. When it comes to me and Big Fat Rush Limbaugh, for the most part, we just disagree.
So let's leave it alone, 'cause we can't see eye to eye. There ain't no good guy, there ain't no bad guy.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
There's only you and me, and we just disagree.
It is so rare that I tune in to the right-wing Rush Limbaugh radio program and hear him say something that I agree with. Now, this kind of cosmic alignment, this rare convergence, didn't last long. And you may know that back in the 90s, I spent 3 years on KNBR in San Francisco following the Rush Limbaugh show every day. It was a hoot, dealing with the ditto heads and their pre-programmed ideas was often challenging and quite often interesting and entertaining. But today I was shocked because Rush Limbaugh broke with the GOP pack on the issue of the battle between Apple and the FBI over encryption of iPhones and the FBI's demand that they be able to bypass the encryption. And I was frankly surprised. Because Donald Trump says it's a no-brainer, Apple is wrong, Tim Cook is arrogant, and they should submit to the government. Most of the other candidates for president on the GOP side, see this as a no-brainer. They take the issues of the San Bernardino crime and spin them up into this ISIS-led conspiracy and say that Apple has no basis to restrict the government from its demands. So I was kind of pleased to hear Limbaugh cut through the crap and assert, as I have, that this is a ruse. The government is using the San Bernardino case and the way the media has played it, and locked it into American minds, and made it almost impossible for Apple to stand on principle. Now, Apple has not always stood on principle. There is a history, and you're hearing about it today. In more than 70 previous cases, Apple accepted government warrants and opened iPhones. But since 2014 and since the Ed Snowden revelations, Apple has aggressively moved to improve its encryption and protect its iPhone users. And it's fair to say that the government is not just trying to open a single phone. Farouk's phone. The government is using this as a pretext to set a new precedent. And down the road, it won't even be applied to terrorism cases. They'll find a child molester or a kidnap case or some other grisly crime. And this is the slippery slope to a police state. And we're gliding right down it at a pretty good clip. So I will take the support of Rush Limbaugh on this issue. As you'll hear in a couple of minutes, it didn't take long for him to return to his usual anti-liberal diatribes. But in this matter, Rush and I agree, and that's so rare that we will revel in it. So The Guardian, with Spencer Ackerman in New York and a couple of other reporters, have done a good job of giving us the background on this. Now, the recent request started a couple of weeks ago when the FBI called Cupertino and said they wanted Apple to hack the iPhone that they linked to the shooters, the alleged shooters, in San Bernardino. On the 16th of February, a federal magistrate, that was this week, ordered Apple to help the FBI unlock that single iPhone, and Apple has refused. And when you look at the history here, Tim Cook has been very clear. He met with the spooks just a month or so ago and flatly refused to open a back door to the iPhone. Now, he's being attacked, as is predictable. Tom Cotton, who is a particularly low-life member of the United States Senate from Arkansas, he's the guy who committed treason when he authored the letter to the Ayatollah about a year ago attempting to undermine our president's efforts to negotiate a deal with Iran. And he said Apple chose to protect a dead ISIS terrorist's privacy over the security of the American people. Now, he, of course, does away with the standard practice of saying accused, alleged, or reputed. Because, you know, I've made it very clear. The government has managed the coverage and the narrative of the San Bernardino shooting last December 2nd. And the media accepts it without skepticism, without challenge. And it's riddled with holes. And the claim that these are ISIS terrorists is dubious. At most, they were inspired by what they see or saw as jihad. And so last October, James Comey, director of the FBI, abandoned his push for legislation that would require Silicon Valley to maintain these backdoors under pressure from the White House. But then on the 9th of February, he testified before Congress that the FBI was unable to unlock that phone in San Bernardino. And over at the NSA, Admiral Mike Rogers called encryption the problem that prevented the prevention of the attacks in Paris in November. Now, so much of this is wishful thinking. They make this claim, which really is unsubstantiated, that if only this, if only that, we could have prevented these attacks. It's a sad, sad reality that not all attacks are preventable. Even if we give up every right and every call, every communication is intercepted by the government and Big Brother can watch over each and every one of us all day long. Now, that'd be a real job creator, wouldn't it? But it is preposterous. And it's only in Hollywood movies and dramatic television shows where those kinds of things occur. Now, here are some of my fundamental problems with the FBI case here. And the White House joins in. Senator Feinstein joins in. There are a lot of apologists for this bullshit. Number one, the phone that they want to hack into, they have a backup from iCloud up to and including the middle of October. So at most, there is 6 weeks of communication on Farouk's work phone, the phone that he used as a restaurant inspector for San Bernardino County. And if he used that phone, which seems far-fetched, for his communications with any other sympathizers, jihadists, people who helped him rent the car, you know, any of this stuff, the government already has the metadata. They know what calls were made to and from that suspect phone. All they have to do is go to the other party and say, we have a subpoena, we want you to open your phone and show us any text messages, any phone calls, any voicemails, any emails that you sent or received to Farouk. So this whole episode is completely unwarranted and unnecessary. And as I stated, I'm doubtful that this phone has any information that really would be valuable. But even if we suppose it does, if it has a ticking time bomb, the government has ways, without busting Apple's encryption, to get the communications that they desire. So the narrative continues that the FBI lawyers have come up with a kind of clever approach. They're saying, don't turn off the encryption. Just rewrite the operating system so that the FBI can guess the password to the phone as many times as it takes to crack it. So there are about 10,000 possible combinations of four-digit numbers. And the FBI is saying, well, we can't just run them one after another because after 10 tries, the iPhone will shut itself down and erase itself. And when we look at this whole situation, the government is demanding a new operating system. And let's credit Dan Guido, co-founder of security analyst Trail of Bits, And he said that this system would be called FBIOS. You know that Apple calls its iPhone system, the operating system, iOS 9, iOS 8, whatever. So Tim Cook is standing on solid ground here. In his letter to the government, he said, "We're challenging the FBI's demands with the deepest respect for American democracy and a love of our country. We believe it would be in the best interest of everyone to step back and consider the implications." Well, as you know, I don't respect Apple as a tax cheat, but I certainly do respect it for this principled stand, and I hope that they will resist efforts to cave. And it was back in January in San Jose that Cook was right at the same conference table with John Brennan of the CIA, Mike Rogers of the NSA, and James Clapper, the top spook in the country, head of the director of national intelligence. And to his credit, Tim Cook looked him in the eye and said, no backdoor to the iPhone. A couple of other items on this subject, that if Apple does cave in to the government demand here, the precedent that it sets is really critical. And in a report from cybersecurity experts published by the White House last summer, they wrote, "This is not only an American issue. The British government promises legislation to compel communication service providers, including American-based corporations, to grant access to UK law enforcement agencies, and other countries would certainly follow suit. China has intimated that it may require exceptional access." And so there is no end to this effort to unravel the limited security and privacy that we enjoy if we use an iPhone. The other thing that I learned in my reading on this is that Apple devices look for a special signature. So if, for example, I get a message that there's a new iOS available for my phone, my phone will not accept that download unless it has a special code from Apple. So the government wants Apple to essentially cough up that code and trick Farouk's phone into opening up. And the other thing that I wanted to mention to you, and I'll link to this analysis in the New York Times today by its technology writer, Farhad Manju. The headline, when I printed it out, reads, "Apple's stance highlights a more confrontational tech industry." But in the headline on the New York Times website, it included the language, "Apple holds the cards in this dispute." So Manju says that in the long run, the tech companies are destined to emerge victorious. And he goes through some of the arguments that are being trotted out. And he says, "Underlying all of this is a simple dynamic. Apple, Google, Facebook, and other companies hold most of the cards in this confrontation. They have our data, and their businesses depend on the global public's collective belief that they will do everything they can to protect that data. Any crack in that front could be fatal for tech companies that must operate worldwide." And he says, "Apple's emerging brand is privacy." I hadn't thought of it that way, and that's kind of interesting. And that's a brand I'm willing to buy into if they will maintain their position. So we're going to watch this very carefully. There are town hall meetings tonight with both Republican and Democratic candidates on television. I'm interested in hearing Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton address this question. And I'll be watching that very, very closely. Now, I mentioned that my agreement with Rush Limbaugh was fleeting. Yes, because minutes after his rant about the iPhone security issue that I happen to agree with, he went off on the new dust-up between Donald Trump and not one of his Republican competitors, but Pope Francis. And it's very interesting because when I first heard this reported, I heard the Pope's comments, where in a carefully framed comment, he said, "A person who thinks only about building walls, wherever they may be, and not building bridges, is not a Christian." Now, pushing back, I heard Limbaugh immediately say, "Hey, have you seen that wall around the Vatican? It's 50 feet high." Well, Francis didn't build that wall. And Donald Trump wants to build a wall. There's a pretty big distinction there. And what's interesting is not only did the Pope go after Trump, but on his flight back to Rome, he made a distinction between abortion and birth control. And while he does not support abortion for Zika-deformed babies, he said that using contraception to avoid transmission of the Zika virus is not immoral. He said avoiding pregnancy is not an absolute evil. I would also urge doctors to do their utmost to find vaccines against these mosquitoes that carry this disease. So the Pope is trying to fine-tune his position, and this could be applied to couples who have sex when one of the partners is HIV positive. And the church has said, no, nobody can use any form of contraception whatsoever. The most widely disregarded teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. So the Pope has opened himself up, and in some ways I'm sorry that he has inserted himself in this mudslinging American presidential campaign. And for a moment I thought, well, Trump might be smart enough just to ignore this, not to respond. But, you know, that's just crazy wishful thinking on my part. So he called the Pope disgraceful. No leader, especially a religious leader, has the right to question another man's religion or faith. The Mexican government is using the Pope as a pawn. They should be ashamed of themselves, especially when so many lives are involved and illegal immigration is rampant and bad for the United States. He said he didn't take the Pope's remarks personally. The Pope said negative things about me because the Mexican government convinced him Trump is not a good guy. So he's trying to avoid, and it's funny because Trump used a rare tool, the written statement, to deliver those remarks, which are kind of unusual for him. Today I'm releasing to my subscribers an important new interview, an in-depth interview with Joe Hickman. Joe Hickman was on our program a couple of years ago after he published an important book based on his observations on a night in June of 2006 while he was manning a guard tower at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And Joe Hickman blew the whistle on the deaths of those three inmates that were characterized as suicides by the camp commander, but most of us don't believe that. Now Joe Hickman is back with a new expose. He is a veteran and a whistleblower, and he's becoming a veteran whistleblower, and a whistleblower for veterans. His new book is called The Burn Pits, and he exposes how the contractor KBR operated burn pits at military bases in Iraq and Afghanistan with reckless disregard for the troops and other personnel who inhaled the fumes on a regular basis. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Joe Hickman.
The issue of the burn pit has really, it's just not been reported in the major media outlets, and it's a big story. There's tens of thousands of American soldiers that are sick from these burn pits. And when I say burn pits, I'm not talking about your backyard burn pit. I'm talking about burn pits that were used to dispose of trash in Iraq and Afghanistan that were some as large as 10 acres and burning as much as 50 tons of trash a day. And they were burned continuous, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You can hear the full conversation with Joe Hickman about his important new book called The Burn Pits, where he suggests that Beau Biden, the son of the vice president, was exposed while he was on duty in Iraq, and it led to his untimely death from cancer last summer. And Joe Hickman's publisher has been kind enough to donate a bunch of copies of this new book that I can give away to new subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast. So here's the deal. If you take out a new annual subscription for $50 and you give me an address in the continental United States, I will send you a copy of Joe Hickman's book, The Burn Pits, or your choice, the exciting new coffee table book about the F word called a field manual for the F word by the 94-year-old author Ben Parker, who was on our program recently. So you got options now. Two bonus gifts for new annual subscribers who live in the U.S. And if that's too rich for you, how about $5 a month? Come on over to peterbcollins.com and you click on the menu link, then the Become a Subscriber tab. And it's very easy. It takes 2 or 3 minutes for you to fill out the form, link to a PayPal order, and take care of business. I appreciate the people who support my work, including Diane Noland in Capitola, California, Keita Tom, who just renewed and with a generous bump for another year from Corvallis, Oregon. Also, Linda Lewis near Washington, D.C. is a monthly subscriber and a great contributor of ideas and topics for the show. And Gary Batterson is a longtime supporter who kicks in $20 a month, and he doesn't have to. He does it because he wants to. So I encourage you to become a supporter, a subscriber. Come on over to peterbcollins.com today. Also, we are raising money through our Kickstarter campaign for NewsBud, the important new independent media platform that we hope to launch later this year. And we're better than 10% along. Do I have that right? No, we're not quite at 10%. My math is weak today. We have 689 pledges totaling $65,000 toward our $950,000 mark. We need your help to get there. So go to newsbud.com. That's where you can find the informational video. It links to the Kickstarter page where you can make a pledge. You can share those links on your social media networks via email with anybody who you think would be interested. And I hope we can meet our goal, because we've got important work to do at NewsBud with your funding. The funding's not coming from corporate interests or anywhere else, only from individuals. One more swipe at Donald Trump, and I credit Oliver Laughlin for a column in today's Guardian newspaper. And he takes us back to the case of the Central Park Five. And one element about this that did not surface in my conversation with filmmaker Ken Burns about the Central Park Five. Ken was here at the Secret Studio with one of the members of that notorious group of innocent people, Raymond Santana. And you can find that podcast at peterbcollins.com. Just enter Ken Burns or Central Park Five in the search window. But what we're being reminded of is that Donald Trump, at the time, spent a lot of money signing full-page newspaper ads calling for the death penalty for the Central Park Five. We now know that those five young men were innocent, that the police tortured at least one of them and coerced confessions, and the confessions didn't even match. They were inconsistent. But they were used to convict these boys in a climate that can only be described as hysterical. Donald Trump paid $85,000 to take out ads in four of the New York newspapers, including The Times, under the headline, "Bring Back the Death Penalty, Bring Back the Police." He says, "I want to hate these muggers and murderers. They should be forced to suffer, and when they kill, they should be executed for their crimes. They must serve as examples so that others will think long and hard before committing a crime or an act of violence." Now, all five of these men were ultimately exonerated after the actual rapist and attacker, Matias Reyes, came forward. He met one of the other falsely convicted men in prison, and he took responsibility for that crime. But Donald Trump has never taken responsibility for the egregious and outrageous comments that he made at the time. We have a new Quinnipiac poll. Nationally, it shows essentially a tie, 44% for Hillary Clinton, 42% for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary matchups. Now, these national polls are wobbly because, of course, it's the state-by-state primaries that determine who gets the most delegates to the convention and wins the nomination. But this is important. We also see the race is tightening right now in Nevada, where the caucus for the Democrats will occur this Saturday. And the numbers also show, according to Quinnipiac, that the only candidate that Hillary Clinton can beat is Donald Trump by a mere 1 percentage point. But Sanders beats Trump by 6 points. He beats Ted Cruz by 10 points. He beats Rubio by 6 points. Clinton would lose to Cruz by 3 points, would lose to Rubio by 7 points, according to the current snapshot of the Quinnipiac poll. Senator Elizabeth Warren issued a report last month, and we're just getting some of the details about it. And the report, called Rigged Justice, says, quote, the Obama administration has made repeated promises to strengthen enforcement and hold corporate criminals accountable. Nonetheless, both before and after the announcement by the Department of Justice, accountability for corporate crimes is shockingly weak. And this is one of the critiques that Sanders has been a little bit fuzzy on. He doesn't go directly after the Obama administration for its failure to prosecute Wall Street crimes. He simply deplores the overall situation. And because Hillary Clinton has accused him of being disloyal to the Democratic President Obama, Sanders has, I think wisely, treaded a little lightly on these issues. But, for example, the Senator Warren report shows that the banking firm UBS pled guilty to wire fraud charges in connection with interest rate manipulations. And UBS has made huge donations to the Clinton Foundation, and they paid Bill Clinton $1.5 million in speaking fees. If you're Bill Clinton and your wife has recently intervened in her capacity as cabinet secretary to help a giant corporation avert a significant threat to its bottom line, the very least you could do, if only to avoid the appearance of impropriety, is to avoid negotiating seven-figure paydays with that same corporation. That's a quote from Connor Friedersdorf in The Atlantic magazine. Goldman Sachs is also included in the Warren report, and it owns 41% of the second-largest for-profit education company in the country, and I didn't know this, which is called EDMC, Education Management Corporation. In November of last year, EDMC settled with the Department of Justice on charges that it illegally paid recruiters based on the number of students they enrolled. And because of Goldman Sachs' influence, well, EDMC basically got away with it. So these are important considerations. And Bill Black, who was recently a guest on our podcast, he's the guy who cleaned up the savings and loans in the 1980s. And he has been, he and four other bank whistleblowers, Wall Street whistleblowers, recently issued a manifesto offering the opportunity for presidential candidates to pledge to clean up Wall Street without any new legislation. Just enforce the laws we already have. And a couple of days ago, Bill Black posted at the Huffington Post an item saying, I'd been planning to respond to a Wall Street Journal article called Washington's Corporate Purge that begins with the claim that Bernie and Hillary compete to drive more U.S. companies overseas. The context was a typical journal claim that it was moral to do a tax inversion deal with Ireland to cut a U.S. company's corporate tax rate dramatically. And Rupert Murdoch's minions' explanation of this moral concept goes like this. A CEO obliged to act in the best interest of shareholders cannot ignore the competitive reality. And Black underscores this. He says CEOs have a moral duty to race to the bottom by avoiding paying U.S. taxes? Well, if that's true, he says, then it's essential to either impose a new form of taxation that corporations can't evade, or for governments to cooperate to prohibit such a race to the bottom. But then, says Black, he was shocked that the very same Wall Street Journal on February 11th reported that the Secretary of Treasury, Jack Lew, is challenging the European Union on corporate tax investigations. And this is something that we discussed in the podcast, what he calls Gresham's Dynamic, in which the most unethical companies will drive more ethical companies to operate with lower standards in order to be competitive. And he writes, watching the Obama administration join Murdoch in shilling for U.S. corporate tax evaders and demanding that the EU not attempt to stop the race to the bottom is painful, but no longer surprising. Hillary Clinton says that we must not point these facts out because doing so is disloyal to Obama. Black says Obama is being disloyal to the American people and the stated principles of his party when he shills for wealthy corporate tax evaders. Right on, Bill. You know about the superdelegates, right? There are 712 of them, about 15% of the Democratic Convention voters for president. And Alan Grayson, the outrageous sometimes congressman who wants to be the Democratic senator from Florida and take Marco Rubio's seat, and he's under fire, as we reported last week. We've learned that he runs a hedge fund and appears to have used his status as a member of Congress to try to make the hedge fund more attractive to investors. At any rate, given the surprise that Democratic voters had when they learned that while Sanders beat Clinton by 20 points in New Hampshire, they would come out with about the same number of delegates. So, in a press release I got yesterday, Alan Grayson says, "I'd be perfectly happy if our nominee were chosen exclusively in the primaries. But 15% of the delegates to the convention are chosen because of who they are, not whom they support. And I happen to be one of them. I wrestled with that responsibility for a while until I realized I don't have to decide. I can let you decide." So he is inviting members of the public to engage in an online poll and instruct him how to direct his superdelegate vote. Now, Lee Fung over at The Intercept has done some important digging. He's a public records ace. And he notes that the Clinton campaign not only has lobbyists on its staff and many lobbyists who contribute, but I'm going to quickly go through a list here of people who are lobbyists who are also superdelegates pledged to Hillary Clinton. Jeff Berman, top lobbyist at Brian Cave LLP, helped TransCanada with the Keystone XL. Bill Shaheen, the husband of the New Hampshire governor, Gene Shaheen. He runs a company, but he's also a lobbyist for the American Council of Life Insurers. Joanne Dowdell, another New Hampshire superdelegate, is a lobbyist and the senior vice president for global government affairs at News Corporation, the parent company of Fox News and the Wall Street Journal. Superdelegates Jill Alper, Minion Moore, and Maria Cardona are officials at Dewey Square. The firm previously worked for Enron, Countrywide, Citigroup, and the U.S. Telecom Association, and good old News Corp. Then there's Jennifer Cunningham, managing director of SKD Knickerbocker, lobbyist for public officials, and also is working with the Super PAC run by Mike Bloomberg. Tonio Burgos, a fundraiser for Clinton, is a lobbyist registered to influence New York City officials for Verizon, Pfizer, and American Airlines. Emily Giske, a lobbyist in New York, works for Airbnb, Pfizer, Taco Bell, and a few others. Then there's Dick Gephardt, who is a lobbyist for the government of Taiwan and Peabody Coal. Tom Daschle, lobbyist for the governments of Taiwan and Japan. Chris Dodd, also a top lobbyist for the motion picture industry, and Howard Dean, who is now working at a lobbying firm and is a partner with Newt Gingrich. I'm watching with interest the many questions that are being raised from different political corners about the death of Antonin Scalia, the Supreme Court justice, at an upscale hunting ranch in Texas last weekend. He apparently got a freebie at the ranch, and the owner had some business before the Supreme Court. But there are many people who are raising questions about the cause of his death, the lack of an autopsy, the pillow over his head, and I'm watching that with interest, but I haven't found a real compelling angle on it so far. This is compelling, as I pointed out in my first comments about the GOP effort to block Obama from even naming a successor for Scalia. I imputed it to racist motivations. Basically telling the president that because he's black and liberal, they think that he should sit down and not exercise his right and his duty to make a Supreme Court appointment. Well, in South Carolina, the New York Times found some voters who agree with that. They see this as pretty clearly racist. Here's a hairdresser in Hollywood, South Carolina. "Our president has been disrespected from day one. the words that have been said, the things the Republicans have done they'd have never done to another president. Let's talk like it is. It's because of his skin color. And here's a man who is a former state representative in South Carolina, and he refers to the old constitutional term that black men were equivalent to three-fifths of a white man. He said, I guess many of them are using this in the strictest construction, that Barack Obama, serving three-fifths of a term, or he's three-fifths of a human being, so he doesn't get to make this choice. It's infuriating. And the Republican lockstep is suffering some defectors. People like John Cornyn he's the number two Republican in the Senate. He doesn't rule out a committee hearing on the forthcoming nomination. Senator Heller of Nevada, a Republican, said chances of Senate approval were slim, but the president should put forth a nominee. Orrin Hatch said he opposes a filibuster to prevent a vote, but he says it'd be a nice thing if Obama withheld naming an individual. And the Judiciary Committee Chair, Chuck Grassley, has also said he will wait and see. So it's encouraging that they're not all singing from the same songbook. And finally today, Barack Obama has announced, to no one's surprise, that in March he will visit Cuba, the first American president, gosh, in a hell of a long time, certainly going back to Eisenhower, who made no visit to Cuba. I can't tell you who the last president was, but he deserves a victory lap for what I think is his most significant and successful foreign policy initiative of his two terms. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. You are free to share this podcast with absolutely everyone, and I hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.